Friends, welcome back to the Death with Dignity podcast, episode 3. My name is Andrew Flack, and I will be your host. We are thrilled to discuss the End of Life Option Act with State Senator Susan Talamantes Eggman. Senator Eggman was instrumental in the passage of this bill in 2015 and was kind enough to chat with us about her experiences as a political figure and also her experiences regarding death with dignity. Also, specific shout out to Senator Eggman. She was a fabulous individual to talk to, and we thank her for her time. As always, we thank you for your support and for listening. Enjoy the episode. We'll jump right in. So tell us about your background, Senator. Just some of your, I'd love to hear about your educational experience, where you, went to school and how you got involved in the political arena.
All right. So I was born in the Bay Area in Castro Valley. We moved to Turlock when I was 13. Hard time for a kid to move, and I never quite got my feet back under me very well. I was always smart, had a pretty good smart mouth, but you know, that only gets you so far. My mom, family were immigrants from Mexico. My dad, real grapes of wrath, you know, history. So I was raised with a real hard work and ethic and knowledge that everyone sacrificed so I could have better. So anyway, I was supposed to go to college, but I didn't have the grades for it. And I started working in mental health very early on. So when my first paid job was, kind of like, you know, being a milieu manager, lighting cigarettes and stuff for people in a locked mental health facility back in the like late 70s. So anyway, I went into the military. So I went into the Army right out of high school, just figured that was a way to kind of get myself together. And I quickly learned there that my smart mouth just got me doing a lot of push-ups and crawling in the dirt. And I knew that wasn't the path to get anywhere. So I learned like through that, I talk about learning something like internal locus of control, right? That if I respond to everything outside of me, then I'm constantly giving away my power and letting other people drive the boat. So I, you know, like you find the right time and the right place to go forward. After I got out of the military, and I was a medic, so really in and around comfortable with in healthcare. I worked in a hospital for the most part the whole time I was there, and then ran a clinic towards the end. When I got out of the military, I just did 4 years. Then I started working in substance abuse. So I worked at a old school therapeutic community for drugs and alcohol. I saw the epidemic go from heroin to crack cocaine to methamphetamine back to opioids again. During that work, I got my bachelor's degree in psychology. And through that process, you know, I really learned, I think, that people expect and respect you to call bullshit for bullshit. So I've always had a real frankness that, you know, just kind of let's cut to the chase and talk about it. And then after I did that, I got into end of life. So then by that time, I had taken care of my godmother who had died. And I was sitting at her bedside. I was probably 24 when she died. And kind of delivered that last dose of morphine and was reading her the 23rd Psalm when she went. And my mom, it was my mom's best friend. And so for kind of in honor of her, my mom became a hospice volunteer. And so she was one of the first Spanish-speaking hospice volunteers in the Turlock area where I was from. So she kind of started with hospice and end of life. And then my mom got real sick. And during that time, I got my master's degree in social work. And then was doing hospice work. So I stayed kind of in. So my early medical training in the healthcare, and then through, you know, mental health and substance abuse work kind of ended with end of life work. and then during that time, well, I guess my mom, I got encouraged to go up and get my PhD. So I'm like, oh, you know, kid who barely graduated from high school. Now people want me to get my PhD. And I remember telling my dad, you know, I'm going to be 40 when I'm done. He's like, well, girl, you're going to be 40 either way, with a PhD or without a PhD. So you decide. So I went, it was fantastic. I did a lot of work. I taught while I was there, and I worked in the emergency rooms at the in the Providence Center, big hospital. So I like kind of fast-paced, challenging things. I love teaching. When I finished my doctoral program, I got a job at Sac State. By this time, my mom was really sick. My mom became very ill in the late 1900s, 1999. She got really ill, and then I ended up in Stockton because then I could work at Sac State and then go home and take care of her. Because as the oldest child of a Mexican American family, that's what you do. And when my mom, she had this rare disease called Wegener's granulomatosis. And it kind of destroyed every system in her body. And towards the end, she had to be on dialysis. And I remember when she had to be on dialysis telling her mom, at least now you get to decide when you die, right? Because you can stop that if the pain gets, right? Because that was and she knew that she had to be on it to save her life. And it was the, and I should back up a little bit and say, during my doctoral program, I was in Oregon in 1997. And that's when the End of Life Options Act went into effect. So I was there through that. I did my my doctoral research program at a center for the Oregon Healthcare Medical Center for Ethics and End of Life Decision Making. And then when I did my dissertation, I came back home with my mom. We did this real cultural, the intersection of Mexican American culture and the American healthcare culture as they intersect at end of life. So with my mom, and we went up and with the car up and down the collecting stories of people, families who had cared for someone as they died and traversed the healthcare system. And we kind of did it very culturally competently and presented it through stories or testimonials about people's experience. When I finished, as soon as I finished, my mom died. So her last trip was to go see me defend my dissertation. And so it was at the very end of her life. And I remember I went and taught a class, and I came back, and my sister was assigned to watch my mom. And she was like, I got to take her back to the hospital. And I went in, and I'm like, Mom, are you okay? She's like, oh, I'm so tired. I'm just so tired. And she had just been back and forth and back and forth and just, you know, had very little quality of life left anymore. And I said, you don't have to keep doing this. And she just laid down. She's like, oh God, thank you. I'm just so tired. And she decided, because she was on the home dialysis that we did every night. She undid it. We called all the family together. We called in hospice. And within 5 days, she was dead as we sat around the bed, you know, with my whole family and prayed with her. So then after that, I couldn't do end of life work anymore. Like all this work I had been doing, my losing my mother knocked the grounding out of me like nothing ever had before. So I started working in Stockton at St. Mary's, which is a real, you know, serves the poorest of the poor, provides meals. And I helped them develop kind of a social service program. And I used students and, you know, really got into work around community and poverty and food insecurity and housing insecurity. And then my wife got cancer, and I thought, oh God. So I took care of her, and I thought, oh, there's nothing I can do better than just, you know, be more fully and loving. And then there I was, a faculty member. It was 2004, and George Bush got elected for that second time as president. He looks very good now. At that time, as a social worker, it was the whole welfare reform that was, you know, was causing a lot of havoc with the most vulnerable. So the election was on Tuesday. On Wednesday, we go in for the faculty meeting, and everybody's like, oh my God, what am I gonna do? And it was one of those times that I'm like, but we can sit around like victims, but why don't we run? I mean, we're trained in organizing, we're trained in systems, we're trained in working with people. Like, why aren't we running? And why are we training our students? Like, I'm running for the next office that comes up. Sure enough, wow. That was Stockton City Council, and like, I could put up or shut up. So I just started running, you know, and then I'm a lesbian. Like, oh, that's who I am. So anyway, I became the first Latina, first out person to win from Portland all the way down to LA, and you know, in Stockton in the Central Valley. But I just figure if you're there to serve, people will vote for you. And I've always just been like that. Like, so that's how I got into politics.
That's an impressive story. And first of all, thank you for taking the risk and sharing, especially the personal pieces with your mother, very powerful. And I just appreciate you sharing that with us. And I can feel your drive, your energy. How impressive. I mean, it's almost like we hear that term, the American dream, kind of thrown around. And you seem like you're a self-made individual. You came with a very diverse background with your family. Odds were stacked against you, and now look at where you are. So it's impressive, it's motivating, it's inspiring. And again, I can just, even though we're doing this interview virtually, I can feel your ambition and drive, and it is, it's contagious. So very exciting stuff. Now, when you were in Oregon in 97 and the End of Life Option Act became available, did you start thinking to yourself, hey, why isn't this available in California for people such as my mother? And how did that, after you did decide to get in the political realm, was that one of your first areas of focus in terms of your agenda?
So my first office was at Stockton City Council. So, and I did that from 2006 until I went to the legislature in 2012. But absolutely, when I was in Oregon, because I had been a hospice social worker, right? I had sat by, you know, I had just sat with so many families, and every family is different, right? And every experience is different. And there are those who, you know, they want to pray for that miracle and do everything all the way to the end, and you know, you're there with them. And there are others who say, why do I have to suffer like this? Like we treat our pets better. Why do we have to do this? You know, and if you want to meet everybody where they are and to everyone's be able to end life, you know, like it, as they've lived it, right? And if it's praying for that miracle, then that is great. If it's doing everything, but people should be able to live their life on their own terms. And that includes dying on their own terms. So I had already, you know, been thinking about it. And then I saw it in Oregon. And so when I got to the teaching at Sac State, I taught end of life also. And so when I got there, I thought, well, this is an area that I thought I would be able to do it by the end, because my very first term in, I tried to do a bill that just looked at, because before it was like, if you had a, you know, terminal illness from which no cure is expected, and you asked your physician, do I have, they would have to tell you and then tell you, you know, you can have hospice or you can continue treatment. We just flipped it and said, if somebody gets a diagnosis for a terminal illness to which no cure is expected, you have to tell them about what their options are. And they're like, no, it'll destroy our relationship. I should be able to decide. And we're like, people have a right to know. And a lot of people, especially people of different cultural backgrounds or different, you know, languages, the doctor is the God and they're not going to ask, right? The doctor's going to tell me. So just to try to flip that, it was a massive, massive fight to get it through. And so I'm like, whoa, we're never, I mean, but then I felt, like I said, you find that opening. Brittany Menard, you know, went to Oregon to die, and utilized that. And so that just, it just opened things up. And, you know, again, when there's you find that perfect time when the universe kind of opens up for new possibilities, you go. And so, you know, people had worked on it in California before. It was certainly not the first. And then Senators Lois Wolk and Bill Mauney had been working on it. And so we joined forces. And so I don't know if you want to ask more questions or you want me to talk about that.
No, yes, this is awesome. And I heard you mention Brittany Menard, and I love the term you use, how it was like the universe opening up saying, hey, this is an opportunity. So when Brittany had that experience, and this is someone we've talked about in other recordings as well, that for you was that the catalyst, like, hey, let's go, this is a chance now?
Yes. Yeah. I think for the end of life community in general, you know, Compassion Choices, there's people who have been, you know, I mean, working on these issues for a long time and organizing. And then by then there's just I'm wearing my yellow shirt to Compassion and Choices color. Like every time you'd present a bill, you look out and the sea would just, the crowd would be a bunch of mostly women wearing these yellow shirts who had cared for somebody as they died and had gotten, you know, invested in this issue.
That's fantastic. I love it. What was the opposition like when the legislation was coming together, whether it be political figures or groups advocating for maybe religious-based groups who have a different viewpoint and theological, I guess, views and experiences. What did you find as one of those biggest barriers when trying to get this done?
Well, so I probably have never used my actual clinical skills as much as I did through that process, right? Because every time you have, you had to get the votes. And so every time you sit and talk with a member about this bill, you're not just sitting with them, right? You're sitting with their whole experience of death in the room with you. And so there was a lot of, a lot of grief that people shared. There was a lot of feelings. I think that because we're such a death denying culture, we're such a death, you know, it's not, you know, we farm where there's no water, right? We fly to the, we think we're going to live forever. And so there's a lot of aversion to talking about it. And what I've kind of come to, there's a lot of aversion for people who, you know, lost somebody really important to them. It's almost like allowing this would be to say it was okay for their loved one to die, right? They're responding to the policy in the moment, trying to address an issue from their past, almost, it feels like sometimes. You know, and that's the thing with death, the memories and grief and all of that. So in the first way through, again, opportunities, they got it through the Senate, could not get it through the Assembly Health Committee. And it was, you know, a large kind of concentration of Latinas. And it was just a real kind of religious and African-American. There's, you know, for people of color, oftentimes are much more religious and family, very religious based, right? So there was a lot of Spanish radio ads against it, Catholic Church. And I'm, you know, I'm a practicing Catholic and my bishop. And at that time, you know, you get have meetings every 15 minutes in the Capitol. And my scheduler is like, the bishop wants an hour and a half. I'm like, give the bishop an hour and a half. So my bishop came in with five people and, you know, at the end we agreed to disagree, but just, I just try to do everything with respect and making sure people feel heard and understand that we can disagree, you know, on issues. But we never could get it. But then the governor called a special session to work on health issues, most specifically around Medi-Cal, but we didn't see anything in that special session that prohibited us from reviving the end of life bill that had stalled, because there were whole new compositions in the special session. There was a different composition of members on the policy committees. So all of a sudden I could count the amount of votes I needed in health. And so everyone was like, hey, hey. And in fact, that was the lawsuit was like, that was like, it fit. It was just another opportunity. Another place the universe opened up and we.
Yes, exactly.
So, and then the other big opposition was disability rights. A lot of the hospices were not, in support, and we could not have done it if we didn't finally get the California Medical Association to go neutral on it. And that was a lot of work, right? Because in the old days, a doctor was, you know, oftentimes a man who was the decider. As times have changed, you know, as the conversations have changed, as diversity has changed within the ranks, there are more doctors, I think, just open to different conversations. And so they finally came out with a, not necessarily a supportive, but a non-objection. So that was incredibly helpful. The disability rights folks, their arguments are always, we're going to kill all the poor people. We're going to kill all the disabled people. Like that is.
But anyway. Yeah, I think that's probably a little far-fetched in a sense, especially with how the bill is structured. The person needing to be cognitive of sound choice in mind. I think the how it was broken down is very structured, very scripted.
Yep. A lot of guardrails. A lot of guardrails.
Absolutely, especially the different processes to even get to that point with the different mm-hmm. medical people involved. You mentioned earlier about how it seems like culturally, especially here in it feels here in America that we do have an aversion to these discussions, that it is still very taboo to not only talk about the idea of the End of Life Option Act, but just death in general. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. we are finding as we are having more of these discussions that it's taboo in this country. And I wondered, do you have a perspective as to why that is? Is it just not discussed enough? Is it what we see in media or Hollywood and videos? What do you think is a reason as to why there is such an aversion to this topic?
Well, I mean, in many respects, it's the minute we're born, we're running from death, right? I mean, in some respects, we're running towards it. In some ways, we're running away from it. And because it's not just Americans, right? I mean, in many cultures, it's not discussed as much. And again, I think it just depends on your level of religiosity and cultural beliefs. But then there's also that, I mean, we're optimistic creatures, right? And that you're praying for that new technology or that new something, that new, and again, that this feeling that we can do anything, I think is just a huge part of the American spirit. Anyway, we know that. Manifest destiny. It's ours. Here we come. Taking it over.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Being in this political arena, you've already mentioned a couple pieces of your own history and background that seem like things are already stacked against you. You mentioned how you're a female, a person of color, a lesbian.
Yay.
Yeah. And how do you feel these things have, I guess, I'm trying to think of the proper wording, either helped you throughout your political career or inhibited, or people, I guess, using that against you in a way, because we know that obviously in whether it's politics or in general, it seems like there is a slight divide right now and people might not be as respectful based on certain topics.
Yep. I guess I don't know if I would enter politics because I'm looking at the end of my career now. Like I don't think I'll run for office again after this. So I'll term out 2024. Because the vitriol, the level of anger and the division right now is hard. It's hard. It especially, you know, I really try to, again, serve with passion and love the people I represent. And it's hard right now. That makes it hard. And so I think, you know, you need to come in with good energy, right? All of those things are part of me, right? And so I have just learned over my time living to use every one of those as a positive going forward, right? How do I use that to relate to you or to communicate with you or to, you know, to touch you? And I've just always realized that, like, you know, connection and helping is kind of who I am. And all of those parts of me allow me to better connect with people. I'll never forget the first time I ran for office. I'm walking precincts. I got all these ideas. And this lady's like, "Is your hair naturally wavy like that?" "Yes, ma'am, it is." "I'll vote for you because I like that. Right? So you never know what's gonna appeal to somebody. You just gotta be
there. That might be your new. That might be good news for me. I got the curls and the hair flowing here.
Get into politics. You're a natural. You're right. You got dimples too.
Right. Yeah.
Somebody will be a dimple voter. You don't know
exactly.
So you have to be your full, authentic self.
Exactly, and I think this would be the country to be that in, that we thrive off of differences and diversity in this country. And one of the things that I'm slightly circling back to, you mentioned earlier, is just how your approach is showing a high level of respect to others. And even if that means they have a different opinion, maintaining that level of respect. And as we are producing this project, we find that, yes, there are a lot of people with different opinions on this subject. Naturally, it is very heavy and it can be a difficult discussion to be had.
But we all experience it.
Exactly.
Right?
If there's
it's
one thing
universal.
We have in common, exactly, yeah. as a species, it's that we will, yep. no matter what, all experience
no matter what.
A death at some point. Father mm-hmm. Time is certainly undefeated. And I wonder, in terms of the level of respect, it seems like in this country, if you have a different opinion than somebody, it almost seems like you're all immediately chastised and just put away and pushed into the corner and forgot about, if not ridiculed.
Or at least into a box.
Exactly. A box or a group or whatever. And this applies to whether it's something like death with dignity, sexuality, political preference, ideology, whatever it may be. Why do
vaccines,
you think?
Vaccines. Yeah.
Yeah. Vaccines and all sorts of, I mean, almost everything, it seems like. And I was going to ask, why do you think we've gotten into this pattern of having such strong differences and feelings towards other with different opinions? Do you think there's a certain point we can look at in our history, or do you think it's just maybe based on technology, social media, or is there anything, or maybe a combination of these things?
I would say a combination of these things. I mean, you know, people like to point to the last president, but in some respects, I think it goes. I mean, certainly we have seen a level of racism and a much greater comfort with xenophobia. And just kind of meanness, right? We've certainly seen that. In some respects, I think we didn't realize how deep our history of racism was, and that it made, I think Barack Obama, when he got elected president, I think people were more angry than a lot of us knew. I think there was a lot more.
I agree. I think he was ahead of his time and we just weren't really ready for that for whatever reason.
We weren't ready. And people like, now there's a black man in the White House and the gays are getting married and the women. And it was just like, oh, too much. So much that we went, you know, I mean, and then you add in social media. So it's just, everything is amplified and it's so easy for people to stay in their bubbles and not try to, you know,
yeah,
have empathy. So
right,
my empathy
seems like it's out the window at this point. And
my
just
sister,
social awareness.
Yeah. My sister just had a unique experience. She just flew in from New Orleans into SeaTac in Seattle on Sunday. Somebody's phone got lit on fire after they landed. They had to go down the slider, right? Woo! Nobody's fire everything. So I said, "Well, how?" And she said, "Sister, I was so grateful that people were peaceful and cooperative and respectful." I'm like, our bar is so low that we're so grateful that everyone behaves during a crisis that we're just so, thank you. Right. I mean, that's so sad to me.
Yeah.
We're not even looking for heroes. We're looking for just some decency.
Yeah, it seems like just social awareness, decency, all of that, our ways of interactions, as mentioned, just kind of out the window and gone. That level of respect for each other seems to be diminishing.
Yeah.
When thinking about the End of Life Option Act and where it is heading moving forward, there are still quite a few states who have not adopted any legislation. For example, my home state of Illinois does not have any sort of program or legislation in the works for patients in this situation. And out of curiosity, I wondered if you have an idea or vision or thought as to how this type of program might change as we move forward. Will other states adopt it? Is it going to be something that might still be standoffish, or maybe even someday a federal mandate at some level? So I wondered what your thoughts are there.
Yeah, I don't know that we see it federally, but I think we'll still see state by state, right? I think we have Maryland now, I think New Mexico. And it's interesting, New Mexico passed it because, right, it's got a high degree of people of color. And that's oftentimes what you see, because the majority of folks who use it tend to be Caucasians who don't have a large degree of religion, but do have a large degree of education. So it's interesting when more diverse states start adopting things like this. And I think you'll continue to see it to move, because somebody will live in California, and then, because one of the things that people would say consistently after we passed it in California was, thank God, I don't have to move to Oregon now, right? So I think you'll see people move to a different state. They're like, hey, why don't we have this? And right. that's how movements start, right? And after we have all this data that it's not abused, right? That it's nothing to be afraid of.
Absolutely. The data piece is, I think, one of the most important. And yeah, I'm in education, so as teachers, we say data drives the instruction, right? Mm-hmm, so whether it be mm-hmm. education or other fields, using data and numbers as raw evidence, mm-hmm, obviously mm-hmm. important. And it's nice how these bills are framed so that the data collection piece is in place.
It's a part of it, right?
And kind of see where things are going. Now, do you feel, or how do you feel about people using the medication? And from your experience, what might some of the barriers be for the individual? And just from our discussion, it seems almost like theological beliefs might be one of the bigger factors. And I wonder, have you met individuals who either decided not to use a drug due to spiritual beliefs, or maybe even had a change of heart at some point in their experience with the disease?
I have not, but I haven't worked with people who I don't do hospice work anymore. So I'm not, but I would say that people who generally are using this, what we found from the data is they're mostly all in hospice, right? So that this is somebody who is already, you know, who has been in the fight to live for a long time. And then at some point, right, decides, okay, now I'm going to die on my own terms. Generally that's in through hospice. So it is unlikely that somebody would change their mind. But what we do see is people get the prescription and then don't use it, because it's just oftentimes knowing it's there. It's that peace of mind that people have, because you can continue to move the ball, right? Okay, I'm going to stop when I can't walk anymore. Then you're like, well, I'm still feeling like I have quality of life. All right, I'm gonna do it when I've lost my control of my bowels, right? And then you get there and like, oh, well. So it depends. So sometimes it's just that peace of mind knowing it's there that has and I say that's successful implementation, right? It's just absolutely having your death be more peaceful.
Absolutely. What do you think for you in terms of your career in the political realm, what do you think one of your greatest accomplishments is? Would it be something like the Death with Dignity piece, or are there other pieces of legislation or community involvement pieces that you are the most proud of? What's something that you really like to hang your hat on, I guess?
Well, I think this bill, I'll be known for this for the rest of my life. I would say one of the things that I am most proud of, there is something called a program for kids who have either dropped out or at risk of dropping out. It's called the Challenge Academy. There were two in California, and we got the third one up here in San Joaquin County. So it's with the National Guard. So it's like a live-in 6 month, and kids just turn their life around. So we've now had thousands of kids go through that. So it's with the San Joaquin County Department of Education. And then, so it's just great to see kids come in and, you know, have a second chance and go out. So I love that bill too. And then I did $1 billion for low income housing solar. So that's a really good bill too. It just, you know, helps reduce people with their electric costs, and then gives the benefit of solar to poor people who don't usually have it. Right. So I'm very proud of that as well.
Yeah, those are two fantastic works there.
Yeah, and then I do a lot of work in the mental health space too.
Sure, absolutely. And when you were back when you were in LCSW working with hospice individuals, did you ever think this is where you'd be? Did you ever think someday I'm going to be working on legislation and I'm going to try to get this passed in California? Or was this one of those things, as you mentioned, the universe unfolding?
The universe just kind of, rolls in. I had no plan to ever run for public office. None.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well,
I just keep stumbling. The universe opens up and I'm like, whoa, okay, I'm going.
Yeah, that's how it happens. Absolutely. That's what I do. Very cool. Now, tell us a little bit, and I know I want to be respectful of your time, so I know we're getting kind of low here. Can you tell us a little bit about the proposed amendment from February? I believe that there was an amendment proposed for the End of Life Option Act, and wondered what your thoughts were there and what that looks like.
Yeah, so it's been another big fight. So it's timely we're speaking today because we got it out of appropriations, and we didn't know, so I had to get all the resources again. This is my last term, so I want to try to. So we tried to remove the sunset. But they didn't remove it, but they moved it to 2031. So, okay, and someone will do it later. But the one thing we did was we wanted, from the data, we find that people oftentimes were trying to use it and couldn't wait that 15 days. Because, right, you think your doctor's going to be your first person, and they're like, oh, no, now we're the dignity. Now we're Catholic, we can't. Like, oh! So then you have to go find that initial person and then wait that 15 days. And it was just, it was what started off as a guardrail became a barrier for use. So we'd want to get that down to 48 hours. We'd like, ideally to get rid of it altogether, but down to 48 hours between those two. You still have to do the written attestation. You still have to see two physicians. You still have to do all of that, but just it can be more compressed if your condition requires it.
Absolutely.
Especially folks with ALS or something, all of a sudden, because right now you also have to self-ingest. So that was the main parts of it. And also then when you go see that first doctor, they have to document. So at least we can see when the clock should have started, if that person would have done it, and then refer that person. So we did that, tried to get rid of the sunset, but it extended to 2031 and then reduced that day, which is what we really wanted to do. And then also just kind of made it more clear that people could, you can't use it in a public space, but that meant like a park, not a hospital. And some of the hospitals were like, all right, we're public. Just to say you could use it in public spaces.
Right.
And so we got it out of appropriations. And so the final stop will be the assembly floor. And then I think back to us for concurrence and then the governor's desk.
Excellent. It's great to hear that it got out of the appropriations, as you said. And from reading a little bit about the process of the bill and the amendment as well, I appreciate how you people are using the data-driven approach and coming up with the different solutions to some of those, what could be considered now a barrier, because yes, 15 mm-hmm. days is a long time for somebody to wait who is, struggling and with the mm-hmm. disease.
And it's this double standard, like I had to go to talk with some of the members who are very progressive Democrats. And that's why I said, do you support a woman's right to choose? Oh, of course. Cause the Catholic thing, I said, and let me ask you this to a woman, right? Would you feel comfortable telling a woman who came in to want to get an abortion to tell her you didn't quite trust her decision-making and she should go home and wait 15 days and then come back? Would you feel okay with that? Tell me how it's different. You walk me through it.
Sure. Yeah.
I got the votes. I eventually got the votes.
Excellent. Well, you're doing your job and you're doing a good job of it. That's for sure. And that does lead me to ask. So this is our first discussion and encounter. And as mentioned, I got to say, I love your energy, your vibe, just everything about you and what you're doing here and some of the bills and other projects you've shared with us. I got to ask, is there any other chance you consider running in the future again? You mentioned maybe that this will be the end of your political career. And with that, are people hounding you, or are they saying you got to stay, Senator? We need you for another term. How does that look for you?
Well, I'm turned out of the Senate. I've done my 12 years that are available to me in the legislature. So I'd have to go somewhere else. And what I say is, haven't I done enough for you people? Can I rest? Anyway, I never say that's, never.
That's
I never
fair.
Say never, but you know, I didn't even share this part with you. My wife, now it's 39 years, 40 years is next year that we've been together. And so she's a 2-time cancer survivor and now pretty disabled. She's got a lot of mobility issues. She had a tumor in her spinal cord. And so I'm a caregiver too. But in 2013, it was my first year in the assembly. She had one sister who got pregnant at 45. And we said, are you out of your mind? Don't think we're going to be helping. Anyway, she on June 11th, she called Renee and said, take me to the hospital. I'm dying. We said, you're crazy. You don't have healthcare insurance. Indeed, she had a really, really vicious cancer. And she died August 11th. And her beautiful little girl came home with us the next day. And we became parents. And so I have a 13-year-old. So I have a teenager.
Wow.
And a sick wife.
Yeah.
And I'll be 63. Come on. That's enough.
You do self-preservation. Certainly you got to be in charge of yourself and you. Yeah. Have
but
done
you never
a lot
say never.
A lot of people.
Universe might open up. Universe
exactly.
might open up, brother.
Right? I love it. I love it. Well, listen, I that's about all I got. And again, I know we are okay. limited on time here.
All right. I'll come back and talk again. Clearly.
Yeah, we would love to talk with you. I feel like we're just scratching the surface. And if nothing else, just to hear some of your cool stories. It seems like you've got so much wonderful experience working with different people of different backgrounds. And it's obvious that you are saving the world one day at a time. So Senator Susan Eggman, we really, really appreciate it. And if there's anything else you'd like to share, the mic is yours.
Yeah, just thank you. Thank you for the time. I really enjoyed the conversation. And I hope husband has a good time in Chicago visiting his family.
Absolutely.
And you don't have to use the slider. You don't have to use a slider when you land, but if you do, that people are interested.
That's good to know. Well, thank you again so much. We'll certainly be in touch. And if you need anything from us or on our end, please reach out. And
okay. Will you send my staff
the
podcast?
For sure. We'll send you the links, sound bites. Once we get it all up and running and release everything, we'll definitely right. keep you involved.
How were we, husband? Were we okay?
Yeah. It was good. I don't know if we're still recording, but I'd like to ask you one question, if that's cool.
Sure.
We are. And yes. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to ask. I got in a discussion with some doctors in the state of Illinois, and being in California, it's so different. People are more educated about the whole topic. That's something they can prescribe. The doctors are from Virginia and like Illinois, and they just were so not like aware of it. You know, it just wasn't part of their just knowledge. And I guess like I would just want to ask you, what do you think if you could like steel man the argument from the other side that you hear often? Like, what do you hear from people that do not want to participate? Is it purely a matter of religion, or is there something else there?
No, I think it's just that self, it's religion, right? They say it's God's will. I think, well, if it's God's will, why'd you go to the doctor in the first place? Right? The logic, the logic makes me wacky. Like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I'm on your side. I've just been trying to like understand it, but that's, yeah.
Yeah.
That's all I
for most, for most of our adult positions, right? They'll say it's against my Hippocratic oath, right? Do no harm. But so, and that's the thing, right? That's the rub for people. You are prescribing something that is going to end somebody's life. In some respects you could say making somebody live in ways they don't want to is doing harm. So it's more of a moral and ethic issue, but I will tell you the American Medical Association has endorsed it. So these other doctors will come along in time. I think they'll come along.
That's what I told them too about the AMA.
Yeah.
That's huge. Thank you. I think you guys did a great job, by the way. I really enjoyed
Thanks.
It.
Thanks.
Who's your audience, Andrew?
Oh, boy. Audience. Well, you know, we're not exactly sure who this is going to reach, but I've got a decent group of friends and family who are interested. We've worked quite mm-hmm. a bit with UCSD and the doctors there, and we're hoping their media team helps us get this out to the public. But basically, we're just hoping that this is something that will provide positivity for people who are in similar situations, whether it be a patient themselves, family members. We're trying to cover different angles of the topic, just looking at the physical, social, emotional, and spiritual elements to all of this. And I've said, Hosman and I both kind of agreed from the beginning, if nobody listens to it, that's okay. We're finding okay it's too. Been cathartic, and it's been
a good conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me in this position, it's really helped me process and feel more comfortable with the path that I'm on. And as you mentioned so much, and I know I'm going to be smiling for a while, but I often refer to the universe and let it unfold as it should. That's kind of what I believe. And this process and meeting with you and some of these other people help reaffirm that it's okay. And this is part of the path. So I'm hoping that whoever wants to give it a listen, hey, hopefully they'll enjoy it, and we'll just see how it plays out. I'll definitely make sure to be in touch with you moving forward, and make sure once we release these episodes, we're getting you guys involved too and your team.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure talking with you. Have a wonderful day and weekend.
Okay.
All right. Take care.